Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded. Today, I am with Dustin Nguyen. I grew up at a time where there was no Vietnamese or even Asian men on screen. And you were certainly the first Vietnamese. And I don't even remember a time when I was growing up where you weren't there. You know, and all these years watching you progress through different hats in the film industry has been phenomenal. And I've waited a long time to sit and have this conversation, even though we've known each other for a long time. So thank you and welcome to the Vietnamese podcast.
Well, that was a very kind introduction. Thank you, Ken, and thank you for having me. I know we tried to do this a few times, but the timing wasn't right, you know, I guess.
Yeah. And that's a funny thing about timing because, you know, I've been at this for a few years now. And what I realize is every time I need to wait for somebody, they have more projects and more things that we can talk about. So I'm always patient because, you know, it's a beautiful thing to watch all of the people in our world get better at what they do and stack more credits to the things that they do. So this is a great thing.
Last time I saw you in person, I think it was at Sundance, correct?
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was at Sundance.
Oh, yeah. Let's get into it.
You came from Vietnam, and how did you break in? How did you even think about getting into the film industry?
Well, I think I'm one of those people who are fortunate enough to know, you know, from very early on what I wanted to do with my life, you know, and when I say early on, I can recall, you know, 8 or 9 years old, watching those Hong Kong movies, growing up in Vietnam and just felt, first of all, I was very moved by them in a way, that when you hear good stories and exciting stories and then remembering that, thinking, I want to be the people who make these kinds of films or movies, I call them at the time. And I remember in high school, I was a guy that joined like I think they called the electronic club or something, where you're the guy that would set up, you know, you run from room to room, you set up the slide machine, you know, projector for classes, or you bring in the movie projector they're showing, things like that. And started researching, you know, what a producer, movie producer, movie director. And that's kind of how I got started. And when I graduated from high school, I moved, you know, well, first of all, you know, I came over, like most of us, I came over to the United States in 1975. We were the first wave of immigrants, or refugees, if you will. And we settled in St. Louis, Missouri, because a church that has sponsored us. And then, so I went to high school there, and when I graduated from high school, I had my eyes set on UCLA or USC Film School. Right? So that brought me west to California and applied for UCLA Film School because I couldn't afford to go for USC at the time. And then I didn't work out. I didn't get accepted. So I went to Orange Coast College to sort of buy time, you know, and reapply the following year. And during that time, I started making short movies. You know, back then, this was like pre-MTV, you know, music videos, and I was making these short, you know, different imagery that I felt was very moving, and putting it against songs and things like that, and using actors' friends who were in the theater department. That's kind of, I guess, I never thought I was going to be an actor. Actually, that idea really was very scary. And I remember one of the actors that I was using in my short films, he had an agent, this sweet Miriam Bond, woman, Jewish woman. And she would come to me occasionally, and I was attending these acting classes, not to participate, but I thought I should learn a little bit about how actors work and how what they think and all of that. And so I would sit in the back of the class, you know, that kind of a thing. And she would come up to me occasionally, and she said, "Oh, you know, I don't have any clients your type, you know, and you want to be an actor, you know, I'll represent you." And I was like, no, Miriam, no, it's the last thing I want to do. But it's funny how life works, you know. And so during the year that I was waiting to reapply to UCLA, and my friend Leon, he said, "Man, you know, you should give it a try, do commercials or something. You know, you got to wait around for a whole year. You got nothing to lose." And I said, "Okay, what the heck, you know, if I can make some money doing commercials and stuff." And so she sent me out, you know, for a couple auditions, and it pretty much reconfirmed to me that I'm not made out for it. I was like, I had no idea what I was doing. You know, these cattle calls back in the day. I don't know if they still have it, but they call them cattle calls. They're just hundreds of people. And commercial acting, you know, you got to be really animated. And I was far from that. I was scared out of my mind. This is not a good idea. I told you so kind of thing. And man, this story is getting long, but.
No, it's so interesting. Yeah.
and you know, it's a cliche, typical struggling actor story. I was literally living in the office of Miriam's office, sleeping on the couch, helping her. Back in the day where you used to staple pictures with resume, you know, of actors, and that's would be what was submitted back in the day, and helping out and things like that. And so unbeknownst to me, she sent my picture to the casting office of Magnum PI, the original show. They were apparently looking for a kid to play a Cambodian freedom fighter in a 2-hour special, you know, when they used to do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
This is the height of Magnum PI. And so they wanted to see me, and I was like, "What? You know, where did you do this? What do I got to do?" And I didn't know what sides were. You know, they give you these pages to read. And she goes, no, go down there. Go down to Universal. They want to see you. I remember it was a Friday night, close to about 4 or 5 in the afternoon. And Ken, I went down there, man. I had these pages in my hands. I didn't know what to do with them. I was trying to memorize them, and I didn't know anything about acting. And somehow I went in the room, and the whole thing was just overwhelming, and I read these pages to them. And as soon as it finished, I just wanted to get the hell out of there, you know? I was so embarrassed. And,
you know, I want to stop you because you were like a little older when you got to the U.S., and your English probably wasn't where it is today, right? I mean,
I had everything working against me, you know? And I mean, you adapt, you try to, but you know, I got here when I was like 10, 11, and I worked really hard at it, but certainly all of that going against you, you know, and being extremely shy. Yeah. So, you know, again, it was such a frightening experience, and I just wanted to run out of the room and wanted the producer, like, you know, hey, just sit down. We want to talk to you. I think they kind of saw that I was nervous, and then they started, "Hey, you know, where you're from," and blah, blah, blah. So I had to kind of go through the story, kind of like I'm doing now, you know, come from Vietnam. And have you done anything? No, you know, are you in the union? I'm like, "What union?"
What is a union?
Exactly. Bro, I didn't even know what SAG was back then, you know? And left there, went back to the office, and as soon as I walked in there, you know, Miriam said to me, they want you. You got to fly out to Hawaii
Monday. You know, this is a Friday. Wow. I'm like, what? Fly out to Hawaii? I thought it, you know, and I thought it was like a some bit part, and it turned out to be like the one of the lead guest stars, and you know, I was going to be there for a month. Man, it was like crazy. You know, I don't know how I got it. I went to Hawaii. I did this show for them, and every day was like just frightening because I, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. I thought for sure they were going to fire me eventually. But everybody was like amazing. You know, Tom Selleck left a very strong impression on me, even now, in terms of how to conduct yourself on a set and on a show that you're the star, and how to treat other people, and how he, I saw how he treated his fans. He's just a humble man. And he knew I was green, and he was encouraging me. The rest of the cast, too, you know, and the producers. And some of them I stayed friends, you know, long after. Mm-hmm. But it was an amazing experience. And but still, can you know, I came back from it, went back to waitering on tables. You know, it was very, it wasn't like, oh, I'm going to be an actor now. I still got my mind set on UCLA Film School, you know. I'm like, it's going to come around, I'm going to apply again. And then somehow I just kept landing jobs with actors. You know, I landed the soap opera, General Hospital. I worked on it for a year. And then it became clear to me that, hey, you know, I should take some acting classes, because if I keep booking jobs, I got to know what the hell I'm doing. So I started studying. And I found... It was a major life-changing moment, in a sense where it wasn't like, oh, I'm meant to be an actor. What I mean is I learned so much about myself. Yeah. And how a lot of things in my past had made me so introverted. And I learned a lot about how I click emotionally. It was very therapeutic. And then I landed at 21 Jump Street, you know. Again, by this time, I'm, you know, I'm kind of know what I'm doing in terms of what the business is about, and I landed the show, and at the time, none of us knew it was going to be a hit. We're just happy to get a job, you know, and there was this Fox network that no one heard of, and then somehow the show became a huge hit, you know, and off I go, and I never looked back, but I guess. I want to kind of bring back to what I really wanted to do, right? So life works in a funny way, because while I was working on 21 Jump Street and subsequent TV series, I realized this is like the best film school for me, because we had all these different directors coming in and out of the show every episode. And so I would you know, come to them and I said, hey, you know, can I follow you around, you mind, and learn from you? And they were like, oh yeah, great, you know, come, Dustin, you know. And they were very generous. And I would that's where I spend my time, you know. Like, instead of being in the trailer or something, I would be with them, and I'd be like, why did you pick this location? You know, why did you choose this cam, this lens, and why did you light it like this, and so on and so on. And you know, even on a producing level, I was like, you know, why are we scheduling these scenes this way, and what do you do if this doesn't work out? And it was just the greatest time, you know. And subsequently with other series that I end up on as an actor, I learned so much. And then I kept working as an actor, and I fell in love with acting. Eventually, I realized what a wonderful thing it is. But it, all in all, you know, it just I just love making movies, whether it's acting, directing, or not so much producing. But I love being on a set. You know, I could be a script supervisor, I could be a gaffer. I just love that atmosphere, you know, the sound of it, the taste of it, and everybody's working for a common goal, you know, things like that. And then you end up with something for the audience. Hopefully it's watchable.
Yeah. You know, there's not a single sort of person at the time where I could say to myself internally where there's Vietnamese people that were working alongside you or on screen. I mean, were there Vietnamese people in the 80s that were around you?
If there was, I wasn't aware of who they were. I haven't met them yet. Yeah, there, you know, later on, I remember the first time I met a lot of Vietnamese was I landed my first feature film. And you blink and you miss me in it, you know. It's an Oliver Stone film called Heaven and Earth, where I played, you know, part of the family of the lead girl who passed away. She's a sweet woman. I played her brother, and I was in the I was shooting it for like 3 months in Thailand, but I on screen you blink and you probably miss me, but it was in that production I met so many Vietnamese actors and or people who eventually acted. Some of them never acted before on this film. But when I was doing 21 Jump Street, I didn't know of any at that time. Yeah,
you were working alongside big actors. Back in the day, it was Tom Selleck. He was like our George Clooney today.
Mm-hmm.
He was massive to be working alongside him. And then obviously Johnny Depp. I mean, we all know Johnny Depp today.
Mm-hmm.
But Johnny Depp was a very young man who arguably got his break with 21 Jump Street, and you were...
No debate about it. I mean, that show launched his career, all of our careers, but certainly Johnny, you know, back then, I already saw what a star he is, you know, how unique he is as an artist. So it's no surprise to me that he went on to become, you know, a huge star that Johnny became.
And do you keep in touch with people like that throughout the years?
Not so much Johnny. We see each other occasionally at film festivals. He has a movie. I have a movie. I think last time I saw him, we had films at the Toronto Film Festival. And it's one of those things, Ken, like... I hear somebody, Dustin, and you turn and it's him, and you haven't seen each other for maybe even 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years, and we end up having dinner or hang out, and it seems like yesterday, you know.
Wow.
Except now he's got bodyguards and stuff, but Holly Robinson, who's a dear, I consider her a sister.
Wow.
I talked to her on the phone. Once a month, once every 2 months. We have kids, so we have a lot of that in common. She has a lot of kids. She raised four children, and I got four of my own. And Peter, not so much. Occasionally, again, when I say maybe once a year, because he lives in Canada for a long time now. He married a Canadian woman, and he lived and worked up there. But again, when we get on the phone, you know, last time phone conversation I had with Peter lasted like almost 3.5 hours.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then I can interject, you know, I think Charlie Wynn and then Tim and Tony Bowie were the first three sort of film directors and people that were becoming, I think, the bedrock of the Vietnamese film industry. Mm-hmm. In California. Charlie went on to make movies in Vietnam. And I think, you know, Tim went on to make and produce a few here, and then he went back. Tony Bowie's still here. But when I think about the second wave of, you know, filmmakers, that's probably when I think that you and those guys kind of met up and solidified the early days of the film industries in the late 90s.
You talking about Vietnam, yeah? Vietnam film industry?
Yeah, Vietnam film industry. I think the Vietnam film industry for me probably started to kind of move in the early 2000s. But I think the early stages of that was Tim, Tony Bowie, and Charlie was sort of like...
yeah, definitely were the pioneers.
Those three pioneers. And you were, I remember, you know, meeting you in those years through Tim and Tony Bowie. Yeah, it was crazy, crazy.
Well, if it wasn't for Charlie... I wouldn't even be in Vietnam, you know, in terms of my own journey there, they approached me. They certainly with the Pioneer, they approached me with the Rebel. And I remember I was at the time in my career, well, throughout my career up to that point, I always harbored this dream of doing a movie or acting in a movie where I would speak my mother's tongue, or, and of course, wouldn't it be wonderful to do a movie in Vietnam? And I've never been back in Vietnam up to that point since I left in 75. And then when I got the call from Charlie with the movie The Rebel, that's what brought me back. And I read the script and I could really feel the spirit of the Vietnamese people. And of course, it's about the colonization of Vietnamese by the French and all of that. But that was the journey that brought me back. And then subsequently, I met, as you know, that time the community is quite small, and The Rebel became a hit, a huge hit, which we didn't know. And I came back to do, I got offered to do another movie, and eventually people would say to me, you know, you should come back and be a part of this so-called Vietnamese cinema renaissance period. And that's how I ended up being back in Vietnam. And again, life sort of works out for you in the right time. At that time, I had reached like this glass ceiling in Hollywood. Yeah. I felt like I couldn't go any creatively. I couldn't go anymore than I wished to. And part of it, you feel guilty because you look back and you realize, compared to your peers who were struggling, you've had a pretty good career in terms of the kind of work that you've been allowed to do. But there was this sort of emptiness stories I wanted to tell. And the timing was right, and I had a very personal situation in my own life, too, that made me reflect on a lot of things. And I just packed up and went and said, that's it. You know, I'm going. This is the calling, I think. I'm going to go there and see what's going on. Ended up making some wonderful movies that I wanted to make. Learned so much about making movies. Met my amazing wife, and never thought I would come back to the United States. Yeah, I never thought.
Your time in Vietnam is, it was very productive. I remember there's, you wore the producer hat, the directing hat. Obviously, you acted in a few. But when I think about production in Vietnam, I think about how difficult it is because it's a brand new industry.
I'm going to write a book about it one day. No, nothing interruptive.
I can't wait. I mean, it's a...
Man, I've got some stories. Oof.
God. I would like to hear your opinion about that time. You say I have some stories, but one podcast is not enough for you to even tell probably one story about like the crazy things that happen in film production in Vietnam. But I'd like you to share something, because leaving that part out of the podcast would be a travesty for our audience.
Well, I'll try to sum it up as much as I can. First of all, with the understanding that even now, but back then, it's even, it's such a tiny, tiny, tiny industry, if you can even use that word. But it was growing. It was developing very, very fast, relatively speaking. But you want to produce this cup. And you want to produce the best cup you can. It would cost you, let's say, $10, okay? That's the average cost to make it in Hollywood. In Vietnam, you got to make the same cup. You got to shoot for the same quality, but they give you like $2 to do it. And they give you, the support is not there. Like the craftsman is there. Now, I'm not saying that Vietnamese people are not good filmmakers. What I'm saying, at that time, the developmental process and the craft of making movies was not there. Of course it's not there, because Vietnam was shut down for a long time and there was no interaction with other filmmakers that the local filmmakers can learn from. You know, and I remember some of the films that I saw when I first landed there was still kind of like, you know, Russian 1950s, 1940s, Russian school of filmmaking, you know. I'm not insulting that. I'm just saying it's very outdated and it's not consumable for the average person. And so that's the difficulty. So you got to work with very little support. So the good side is you got to learn to do everything. You got to learn to produce. You got to write, you know, for better and for worse. You got to learn about post-production, how to put it all together. You know, in Hollywood, they have a producer that just focuses on post-production, you know, and delivering the films and the sound and all of this technical stuff. And the working hours are long because there's no union there, and which is fine. You know, there's many things working against you. But out of it, like I said, you learn so much, and you feel like, if I can make a movie here, I can make a movie anywhere, you know, and that's the truth. And the other thing that was a challenge too, I think, because there's no union there, the working conditions are, you know, people tend to get taken advantage of.
Yeah.
And I don't think the people there, the employers, do it on purpose. It's just a way of life there. It's a way of working. But if you're coming from a place like I came from, you're like, oh man, you know, you can't work people like 18 hours a day. First of all, there's no productivity. After 12 hours, productivity goes down. So you try to figure a way to do it, split the difference, whatever. I remember, like, there were directors that I knew, you know, the local ones there, that was very proud of working their crew 20 hours a day. And I'm like, oh, man, no, you can't be proud of that. But my point is you try to work with what you have, and you try to train people or share with people what you know in the way that you work in terms of organizing a production. And eventually, you know, many of us, you know, Ham and Victor and all of these people, we start to find our own circle of crew and craftsmen that you work with that kind of click with you. But that just the physical challenge, you know. Then you have the challenge of dealing with distribution there, which you have to learn as well. That's a whole other business, right?
Yeah.
And then you got to deal with the censorship, which can be challenging. I actually found it relatively easy personally. But you need to know how to navigate all of that and still tell stories that you would like to tell. There's some people there that are not very nice, you know, like anywhere else. And when you're not a local, this is the thing, Ken, you've been there. I met some wonderful people there, wonderful people in the film industry. But for the most part, when you go there, I'm talking like years later when I'm speaking pretty damn good Vietnamese. You know, I've blended in, I've lived there. But they never consider you Vietnamese. There's always that invisible, polite barrier there. So you're never one of them, for better or for worse. But you're not an American. Like, when you're an American, I feel I'm American, but you know what I'm talking about. So, but in Vietnam, specifically, we're talking about that. there's always a little bit of that barrier there that you also got to kind of figure a way to either go around it, hop over it, to get things done. It's crazy. I mean, there are stories that you be like, what? I mean, to this day, I think back about it all the time and I laugh about it. The fact that I even survived it, you know, and if you tell people, they think you're like making it up. But that's how challenging and exciting and frustrating that it is to make movies there.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
You know, the current state of Hollywood and making movies in L.A. is very heavily regulated, and filmmakers really hate it. But when you sit, I just finished a film production a week ago, and it was a 4-week brutal shoot. You know, we all had to wear many hats, and there's all these regulations, and you start to think about why those regulations were in place to protect all the crew, talent, and you realize like those rules and regulations are not in place in Vietnam, nowhere near. And you think about all the talent managers and you think about all the talent agents and you think about all of the infrastructure that exists in Hollywood to make these things protected and work and have longevity completely absent in Vietnam. And you know, I think that you came there literally like a homesteader where there was like the pioneers of the West. There was like no infrastructure. There's no water. There's no toilets. There's nothing when you got there.
Basically. Oh, see, simple stuff like that. You shooting on location, man, there's no toilets. You know, most production could care less. So like if you need to go out in the bush. I'm like, well, what about the women? I mean, us guys, okay, we can go out in the bush and boom, you know, so you think about these things and you try to make accommodations or within your financial means, you know, like, okay, so, you know, some of the houses nearby, let's pay them and ask them if we can use a bathroom and things like that. And let's pay somebody who try to keep that bathroom clean. Simple things that we take for granted here. But it adds up. Yeah. But like you said, I remember there was this tradition of the directors and the lead actors would actually, when we eat a meal, a lunch, a break or something, they would actually have a table for them, right? The director and the lead actors. And then the rest, everybody else didn't have a chair to sit on, you know? And they're squatting with these really awful lunch plates. And I'm like, no, we can't be doing stuff like that, man. Everybody eat the same. If you're going to sit on the floor, you sit on the floor the same. Or you're going to have chairs, you got to have chairs for everybody. And then I remember we used to, like my wife was my producer, and we would do budget. And sometimes some of the financier would be like, well, your food cost is too high compared to everybody else. And we're like, no, it's not high. Food is cheap, first of all. It's higher than what you guys are used to spending. But we want to feed our people right, you know. We weren't doing steak or lobster or anything like that. But these are the things you kind of have to reframe it for people. Like, look, so the food cost is a little high. So what? People are happy. They're more productive. They feel respected. I'm eating the same thing everybody's eating. If you think the food cost is a little high, hey, we'll take it out somewhere else in the budget. But I'd rather have that. And it takes a while for people to sort of wrap their mind around that, you know.
It's a hard switch.
Yeah. Look, independent films making, like you mentioned, in the U.S. is tough too. But there are regulations and things like that, that there's a bottom line that being protected. And it's not there yet in Asia. Not just Vietnam. I've been to China and it ain't better there.
You know, you shot Warrior, and you know, you had a big part to play in. And it was an American production. I'd love to hear your transition back into the world of U.S. Mm-hmm. filmmaking at that point. We're skipping a few films, I'm sure. But
yeah, well, it's actually that is the another turning point in my life where it brought me back to the States, because I never thought I would go back. My agent, my poor agent, was like trying to get me back to the States for years. And Warrior came up. I got a call from Justin Lin, who bought the rights to the story that was written by Bruce Lee, for those who are not familiar with what Warrior is. And I know Justin, prior to leaving and living in Vietnam, I did a movie as an actor with Justin Lin.
To let everybody know, Justin Lin is the powerful force behind Fast and Furious at Universal. He built that franchise. He built the whole thing, basically. He's huge.
Was one of the first, if not the first, Asian American filmmakers that really put his money where his mouth is. You know, people who knows his story. He struggled, and no one would believe in him. He made his indie film. No one would believe in it. It went to Sundance. This is a Better Luck Tomorrow. And of course, his career got recognized and all of that, and became one of the biggest, if not the biggest, in Hollywood, doing these huge franchise films. So Justin would keep in touch with me occasionally, and like, hey, you know, what are you doing over there? And, well, I'm making these movies here, and, you know, let me see it. Send them to me, and that sort of thing. And so I got a call from him one day about Warrior. He said, I'm doing the show, and I have a part I'd love for you to come on. And I was like, Justin, you know, I got a life over here in Vietnam, you know, and I'm in the middle of shooting this movie. I think I was directing something in Vietnam. And he pitched me the show, Bruce Lee, and I'm like, oh man, you know. And I said, well, I'd love to come on if you wait. I got to finish this movie here. And so the long story is, he said, you know, you come on the first season. This character didn't really do a lot, but we want to set him up for the second season and all of that. And that's kind of how it started. And I wasn't like, okay, I'm moving back to America. I went and did Warrior. And Justin is just such a big supporter. He knows I love directing, and he's like, you know, once I get to know you on the show, maybe the second season I can bring your name up with HBO about directing and all of that. So he was very instrumental.
Wow.
You know, and really kind of fought for me, because HBO, all networks really, they sort of have their own list of directors that they go to and that they're comfortable with, which is very understandable.
Normal. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was very hard to break in into that clique. And you know, he was very instrumental, and the executives saw the films that I did in Vietnam and so on and so on. And I ended up directing Warrior's second and third season besides acting in it. And eventually I moved back to America shortly after that. And been here ever since. And, you know, one job after another. It's funny how things work. After Warrior, I ended up doing, Blade of the 47 Ronin. I ended up doing Accidental Getaway Driver. I ended up doing Dope Thief. And I think there's a couple other jobs. But, yeah, it's just been nonstop. And I'm really grateful for it, you know.
Yeah, that's a blessing. You know, and I want to talk about The Accidental Getaway Driver. I saw that it had a theatrical release last week, and I think it's playing in theaters now.
Nationwide. Like, I think nationwide. Like 74 or something theaters now.
It's a big deal. And
you
know, what made you take that that story?
Oh, Ken, I mean, this is like the role I've been waiting for.
Yeah.
I've done some pretty fantastic parts in Vietnam, in Vietnamese films that I'm very proud of, very challenging to me. But in Hollywood, I've never felt like I had something that really, that I could really sink my teeth into. And that story that came up, the producer sent me the article about this real life event. It was a GQ article that broke the story about these three guys escaping from Orange County prison, kidnapping a taxi driver. And I remember reading the article. They didn't have a script or anything at the time. And I was just blown away. I don't know if you ever read that original article, but it really captured, Paul Kix, the writer, captured, he was able to transcend it from a kidnapping, jailbreaking story, and then captured the essence of these guys, which is the loneliness and the isolation, the sense of seeking for what family is, when you're sort of this outcast in society, and the pain that all comes with it. And I immediately could relate to all of this, like I think like most of us.
And
I remember thinking, oh man, we've never seen a story like this in a Hollywood movie about Vietnamese Americans, and if they do make it, I hope they don't screw it up. And it was a long process because they got the director on, they got the script written, they had to get the money together. And I think it was a period of like a good year from the time they sent me the article. And then I went to do some other films in between, and Warrior. And at one point I thought it wasn't going to happen for me, because once they got everything together, I was stuck on something, another project. But as it meant to be, it all came together. And I read the script. I met Sing Lee, the director, and I knew that he would do an amazing job with it in terms of his take on the story. And we shot it very fast. But it was an amazing journey. It's an amazing journey working with you know, Mr. Hip, who played Long Ma, the driver. It was very interesting because I never got a chance to interact with him whatsoever. And literally, we started acting when we met each other on the set, and it was like flying in the dark for me. It was scary, exciting, because there was so much, you know, it's very driven dialogue and a lot of long scenes, and I'm one of those guys that I want to prepare and love to rehearse. We had a lot of time preparing, but not with him. I didn't have that time with him because he's from France. He was living in France. I prepare a lot on my own, and so to start doing these scenes with him for the first time on set was very scary and exciting, and you're not sure what you're doing is right, and you have to kind of trust the director Sing, but it was fulfilling. I think back to your question, because I felt like, man, this, you know, after 30 plus years, I finally got a character that not only a great representation of a small part of the Vietnamese diaspora in America, but it's done in such a universal way too, where a lot of people can relate to what these guys are going through. And I got to speak Vietnamese, and one of my big thing to Sing and the producers, I said, I would only do this film if I have full say on the Vietnamese dialogue. And I said, I'm not trying to take anybody's job away here, you know, bring the interpreter in, all of that. Let's all work together, but I don't want bad Vietnamese on screen. And I said, I'm tired of it, you know, and if I can't get this right, I'm not going to do it. Now, I'm not saying that I'm the best at it, but we spent a lot of time. They were very supportive. You know, Jess Vu and Joseph Hugh, and they have another wonderful professor from Irvine, I think, interpreter. And I work with them a lot on making sure it sounded very filmic and natural and appropriate. Things like that. And so we all very proud of one of the things we're proud of is I would venture to say, and it sounds weird because it's, I'm in the movie, but I venture to say it's the first film in Hollywood where Vietnamese dialogue is actually spoken properly.
Yeah, it's on point. You know, yeah, and speaking of pride and proud, I was there in the theater, the big theater at Sundance, and I watched Accidental Getaway for the first time. At Sundance, and I was so proud because it's, you know, it's when we get to have Vietnamese films at Sundance, you know, it's one of the
Eccles Theater, right? The Eccles Theater, which is
It was awesome. It was awesome to be there, and we're so proud of the work that you did with the film
and all of the, you know, and it needs to be said that close to 80% of the crew is Vietnamese on this film, and most of them went up to Sundance, and there was so, it was such a great moment to have, you know, everybody was there. Not only is it Sundance, it's in U.S. dramatic competition, and but to see all these Vietnamese crew and craftsmen that worked on it, and they were so proud of the product, and being there together, I have to say it's one of the highest moments of my
career. It's a special
career for Ken. And I'm seeing you guys coming up too, you know, that I haven't seen for a while, and Anderson and Ham and all of these people.
Bao.
Yeah.
It was a cool time. Well, another cool thing is Dope Thief. You know, I've heard good things about it from people, and you know, when does that come out, and how can we watch it?
It's coming out this Friday, the 14th Friday. Of March 14th on Apple Plus. I highly recommend it. It's a really good show done by a little director you might have heard of, Ridley Scott, who produced it and directed the first episode, and written by run by Peter Craig, who was an Oscar-nominated writer for Batman and Top Gun 2 and
That's
so on.
Show,
the Town, amazing actor, Brian Tyrese Henry, Wagner Moura, you name it. A drug crime drama that based on another true story in Philadelphia, where they ended up uncovered the biggest heroin trafficking route on the East Coast.
I believe.
And this is another thing that I'm, you know, when luck comes, I guess it comes. So Accidental Getaway Driver is amazing for me. And then I get, my agent said, you know, that this project, they want to meet you. And so I met with Peter Craig and everybody on Zoom, because at the time it was, you know, still the COVID thing. And I didn't know much about it. Another Vietnamese American male character. And their pitch to me, well, not that they had to pitch to me, but that Peter was like, this is, I wrote like a Vietnamese American Tony Soprano.
Wow.
I'm like, yeah, I'm sold.
Yeah, say no more. Say no more.
You know, I want you to learn the Philly accent, and you're like Tony Soprano. You know, this really mysterious, cool guy. And again, my character is very pivotal in the eight episodes, and I don't want to give it away too much. And I'm not even in the trailer. It's a wonderful trailer, but my character ended up being a very important aspect to the second half of the show, so they didn't want to give it away. But my point is, it's another wonderful portrayal of Vietnamese American in America. Now, people would say, well, you're playing, you know, you're playing a criminal or whatever, or drug dealer or whatever. I'm not a drug dealer or anything, but again, I don't want to give it. Everybody knows the show is about two guys, Brian, Tyrese Henry, Wagner Moura, who pretend to be a drug enforcement agent, and they would rob drug dealers. And I'm kind of like their boss, and I'm the guy that moves the merchandise and the money and all of that. And there's many intrigues, but it's a portrayal of Vietnamese Americans that again haven't been seen on TV. Even the lady Co Kieu Chin, who I recommend to play my mother, and it again. You know, towards the end of the show, in the beginning, she's like almost like a background person. You don't know much about it. And then you find out about her character. And it's this, what we know, strong Vietnamese women that we grew up with, especially during hard times, and you see their resilience, you see their all of these things that I've been dying to show American people, you know. And so it's really cool. Again, I'm so excited. I don't want to give it away, but two in a row, I'm like, wow, man, you know, it's about time. And I told Peter Craig and Ridley and all the producers, I'm just so grateful that they've written this wonderful these wonderful characters for this show, aside from it being a really good show. So we'll see. It comes out March 14th, this coming Friday. I think they're going to drop the first two episodes. You meet my character in the second episode, and then I think every week after that they drop one episode, one or two. I'm not sure. Anyway, that's Dope Thief, and I'm really excited. When I saw the trailer, I was like, yeah, this is gonna be good. I mean, I've seen all eight episodes already, of course, but it's I'm excited to see, you know, the world to see the show and get to see this sort of slice of Vietnamese American characters in Philadelphia, which is kind of cool.
Now, when you look back on your entire time in the business, what do you think some of the things that you wished you could have done differently? Are there any things that you could have done differently?
It's a $1 million question, you know. It's you can, I suppose it depends on your framing of it in terms of how you look at things. For the most part, Ken, and not to get too philosophical about it, because I don't want to sound like I'm preaching or anything like that, but I sort of train myself to not think so much of what I could have done differently. I've gone through enough things in my life where I'm convinced and truly believe now that whatever decisions you make in your life at that particular moment in your life, you are making that decision to the best of your ability.
Right.
And you might not see the whole picture. No might about it. You cannot see the whole picture because our brain is only capable so much. There's a divine design to this. And whatever you're doing in that moment, if you're making the best of your ability and you, with all the truth that you have and all the passion you have, it's a little piece of building to something that's about to come down the road. And that could be a million different versions of that piece, depends on what decision you make. But if you truly do it with all your heart and the best of your ability and trust that that's the way, even though you might not think so at that time, most of the time you don't. I found that in my life anyway, it turned out to be true. A few months down the road, a few years down the road, I'm like, damn it, that's what it's all about. That's why I didn't do that project, or that's why I didn't get with this person. And if I could, because had I done that, it would have been a different version of where I am now. Again, it all sounds kind of like metaphysical and ooey-ooey maybe, but I have found in my own life, Ken, that it is, that's how it works, at least for me anyway. So I don't really think of it. There was a period in my life, and I can share this because it's not secret or anything, as an example, and we all have these things in our lives. I went through a very difficult personal situation with my ex-wife where she became completely paralyzed, and our life would just turn upside down, and it arguably the lowest point of my life. And at that time, you cannot see, you know, the trees from the forest, and you just put one foot in front of the other, and every decision you make, you try to do the best you can. And looking back on it now, I wouldn't have done anything different, because had I done anything different, I might not have met my current wife. I might not be have the opportunity to do accidental getaway driver and so on and so on, dope thief. All the pieces fit and it clicked miraculously. And they say God works in mysterious ways, and he or she does, you know. I don't know. It's a silly long answer to the question to me, but
no,
I can't think of anything I would have done differently. There are, well, you know, if you're going to get picky about it, there are times in my life for sure, particularly on movie sets. And I only say that because for me, that's one of the most stressful environments you can be in, especially if you're directing. Very stressful. There are times in my life where I wish I had been a little kinder. Not that I was ever mean to anybody, but when you're under pressure, the tendency sometimes is to say things that you don't mean to, or you're not making the right decisions, or you're not inadvertently you make this person feel like they're not doing their job to the best of their ability.
Yeah.
And or you're rushing through things and you're impatient with someone. And those are the things that when I reflect back on it, and I do a lot, every time I direct a project, make a movie, part of my effort is to be better at that. And I think it's a wonderful arena to train yourself for that, aside from being a better filmmaker. I couldn't think of a, besides war, maybe. Yeah. But making a movie is kind of like war. I don't mean to.
It's exactly like war.
Disrespect, yeah. But what I'm saying, it's a lot of pressure as close as you get. And
I mean, the organization of a film crew is very hierarchical, very similar to, I was a U.S. Marine, so there's a lot of analogies every time I'm on set. And I just see that if you, you know, skip the chain of command, or if you are not, you know, in flow with the team, it really creates a lot of problems that are very similar to wartime problems.
Yeah, and again, it's just being kind with your words, being kind with your action goes a long way. It's a cliche things to say, but it's very true. And yeah. And you only know that when you truly test it in the heat of the moment, you know.
Dustin, I really appreciate, you know, finally get to sit and talk to you, and it's not even enough time, but I think we gone over all the things that that we needed to go over. But I hope in this next year, with more projects and things that we need to get out into the public, you know, we will get back together and have another conversation.
That'd be awesome. That'd be awesome.
Thanks again, Dustin.
Thanks, Ken.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.